Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. This week we're talking about bomb threats and lads mags. Outrage at violent or sexist tweets has sparked a wider argument about what should and should not be said or shown in public, with threats to filter out filth on the internet and to throw a modesty bag over racy magazines. As Victorian values make a return, we ask, will the Twitter abuse lead to a new age of censorship? I'm joined in the studio by Emma Barnett, Toby Young, and Jake Wallace-Simons. A lot of people seem to be saying that Britain is a sick society, that it's time to clean up the filth. The Prime Minister has floated the idea of filtering access to online porn, he says, to protect children. The Co-op has tried to force lads mags to cover up their saucy front covers or face being taken off the shelves. And a backlash against abusive behaviour on Twitter has led to calls for the company to get its house in order. So are we all Puritans now? Or is this all a giant overreaction at risk of giving even more power to the nanny state? Let's start by talking about the kind of abuse that people can get on Twitter. Emma Barnett, you've actually had a bomb threat. How did you react to that?
Yes, last night at 6 o'clock, I received a bomb threat saying it had already been rigged up outside my house and was going to explode at 10:47 and destroy everything. However, it was all written in capped-up letters. It was from an account which was the name of which was a mixture of letters and numbers, so it basically looked like a spam bot to anybody who's vaguely knowledgeable of Twitter, of which I hope I am. So I reacted by saying, oh, that's a bit unpleasant, was about to go block them, didn't have time, was rushing down the pub to see a friend and on contact. I still went to the pub, and when I got out, I did look at my Twitter feed again with the intention of just blocking them, because that's what I always do with lunatics, even with those people threatening to kill me. And they'd actually disappeared already. The account had been suspended. The next thing I knew this morning was on the Today programme. They were covering it on Radio 4. And Catherine Mayer from the Time magazine, she also received the same threat. A few female journalists who'd got the same threat, which I didn't know, had come together and reported it to the police.
Okay, do you know if anyone's been arrested or picked up yet?
Not yet?
Okay, I'm interested in your reaction, though, and it says something about the etiquette of Twitter, the fact that it's teaching people to read things in a certain way, that you didn't immediately think it was serious.
No, I didn't. I have to say, it is the first time, because I do get a lot of abuse. I have my own radio show, and when I come off air, I get a lot of horrible remarks. But it's the first time, I believe, that it's a threat of abuse that could happen offline.
Right.
With a date, a time, and a location. That is actually the
right
first time.
Yet the fact that it was a certain kind of account and the fact that it was all in capital letters made you not take it very seriously.
Indeed.
Right.
I suppose I started to take it a little bit more seriously when I actually thought about it. But I think what's happening in the world that we live in is that communication is so quick. If you are, like I am, regularly communicating, whether it be via a blog or a tweet, it's a cheap form of communication. And I think you develop, or certainly I have, or you don't, a very thick digital skin. And that's what I think you sort of need to have if you feel like you're going to go into the great unwashed that is Twitter.
Jake, you've also had threats, and in your case, the police did get involved.
They did, yeah. I mean, in my case, I poked the hornet's nest a little bit too violently, which was the far right, and was rewarded with a day of extreme abuse. And again, I've got a fairly thick digital skin, but over the afternoon, it was gradually eroded by message after message. I mean, literally every 3 or 4 seconds was another message saying that I should inject a bubble into my vein, or, you know, swallow some carbon monoxide from the back of my exhaust pipe, or slit my throat or whatever. People were jumping on the bandwagon. Somebody jumped on and left a message saying, I don't know who Jake is or what this is about, but he's a right expletive deleted, which is quite funny. But gradually it got eroded over the day, and by the end of the day I started receiving some quite serious and specific death threats. And told the police, and to my surprise they reacted really quickly and really effectively. They found the chap, he was a ex-Royal Marine, so on, took him in, and I've just heard now that they've issued him with a police caution. So
okay.
Yeah.
Toby, Surely someone's threatened to kill you in the past.
Well, I'm in the rather unusual position, Tim, of having been abused this week by the official Twitter feed of Scotland Police.
Right.
And I haven't mispronounced that. They don't call themselves the Scottish Police. I think they call themselves Police Scotland. It was after a debate I had with Stella Creasy on Newsnight earlier this week, in which we were arguing about whether or not Twitter needs to beef up its regulation and introduce some kind of anti-harassment clause into its abuse policy. So we were debating that, and someone from the official Police Scotland Twitter feed described me as a, quote, right tit, which was odd coming from an official police Twitter feed.
Not exactly definite.
And then the following day, I mean, who do you complain to if you're abused by the police? But the following day, maybe. Anyway, the following day they apologised and said they were investigating the matter internally. And I then tweeted back and said, don't worry, I wasn't offended. I don't intend to complain. Please don't punish whoever was responsible. I don't know whether they will or not.
Well, now, obviously, it's not nice to be called something like that, but it's very different from the kind of abuse that other people will get. Do you think there is a difference between the sorts of abuse that men and women get?
Well, it's certainly not the worst tweet I've ever received. I got into a spat with Laurie Penny on a Monday night when we both appeared on Radio 5 Live, and one of her followers afterwards tweeted, when is somebody going to cut Toadmeister's throat? Not exactly a threat, but certainly not very pleasant. But like Emma, my attitude is simply to block people like that. And I think one of the difficulties in trying to insist that Twitter police their own network more rigorously is that will Twitter be able to distinguish between stuff that isn't genuinely threatening and stuff that is? I'll give you another example. A couple of years ago, I was debating Germaine Greer on Late Review, and during that debate, Catlin Moran, the great feminist author who has suggested a boycott of Twitter until they start regulating the site better, she tweeted during that debate, isn't Germaine Greer glorious? I hope she concludes this point by ramming a sword through Toadmeister's head. Now, I would hope that Twitter could distinguish between a run-of-the-mill death threat, which isn't wholly serious, like that, and a more serious one. But I don't know. I'm not confident that they would be able
to. And it's interesting that it's a woman making it, because part of the reason why I've asked Jake and Toby to talk about their own experiences, this isn't just something that happens to women. And yet, I do feel from the news coverage that this is being sold as a woman's issue, and that's the way that some people are presenting it.
Okay, what's your question?
My question is, do you think that this is specifically a problem for women?
Well, obviously it's not. I happen to be a Jew and a woman, and I can get anti-Semitic abuse, which Jake could probably talk to, and some of his articles have provoked that. However, there is a very specific difference between when I've been on television reviewing the newspapers on BBC News and I get off air and I've been on with a man doing the same job, and when we get abuse, I get abuse about my hair, my breasts, how I appear, not my opinions, not what the man, you know, the man gets abuse if they don't like his opinions. So I'm not saying men don't get abuse, but what I'm saying is the nature of the abuse that I have received and how I've seen it directly differ when I've been with a man getting the abuse at the same time off the back of a media appearance. My abuse can often centre around how I appear and not what I say. So I think there can be a difference. I'd be very interested to hear if the gentlemen in the room have been abused about their appearance and they have felt differently about it.
I think Toby was, wasn't he?
I've been abused about my appearance. I mean, I'm abused about my appearance on Twitter approximately once every 30 seconds.
Do people want to rape you?
No.
That's the key difference, isn't it? That when you get that kind of personal abuse, when it applies to women, very often there's a sexual element to it.
There's a very sexual element to it. And, you know, it's just not... There's no coincidence. I've managed to speak to two trolls this week. I managed to get them to come on my radio show. One was called Gary and one was called Peter. Gary and Peter live in very silent houses. They don't sound like they speak to many people. And they very much believe that when women, I'm quoting them, and I'm just, you know, this couldn't be better that you can quote two trolls, that when women put their heads above the parapet, they deserve everything they're going to get. And they specifically said that includes rape threats. And would they ever do a rape threat to a man? I asked them that. No. Why would they? So it's a specific type of abuse, and it's very sexual.
I think, Tim, there's no doubt that, in general, women, particularly prominent women who have some sort of public role get much more abuse than men on Twitter, and it's of a much nastier, more unpleasant kind. But I would be wary of pressurising Twitter to regulate the site more carefully. This was my discussion with Stella Creasy. She claimed to have browbeaten the head of Twitter's trust and safety unit to include an anti-harassment clause in its abuse policy. So henceforth, Twitter would prohibit the kinds of things that that have been happening on Twitter, particularly this week. My worry with that is that Twitter's abuse policy already says that local users have to obey local laws. Threats of violence are already prohibited. Publishing people's private information already prohibited. And Twitter did actually suspend the account that threatened Emma and others with a bomb very quickly, I might add. I think if Twitter introduces an anti-harassment clause, the danger is that that will become a kind of catch-all excuse for kicking off anyone who says anything sexist. And I think one of the virtues of Twitter is that it does have this free and open character, and that's why it's been able to play the kind of role it has in emerging democracy movements around the world. I mean, one suggestion is that you ought to be able to produce some proof of identity before opening a Twitter account, and that would enable Twitter to get rid of the trolls quicker, and they wouldn't be able to come back so easily, which they can now. If you did that, then it wouldn't. If you increased the barrier to entry, it couldn't play the kind of role it has in places like Tunisia. And the other problem is you wouldn't have all these wonderful parody accounts, which are one of the things that make Twitter such a joy.
Jake, would you agree with that?
No, I think that we have to put it in context, which is that there are 4 million tweets being sent, if I'm not wrong, every day, day in, day out, 7 days a week, and so on. And Del Harvey, the Twitter representative on Newsnight, said that there was, I think he said, dozens of staff in Twitter who are dedicated towards flushing out abuse of this sort. Now, if you work out the math, that's something like 25 million tweets per staff member per day or more. Clearly, Twitter aren't really geared up towards dealing with the extent of abuse that you see that's rampant across Twitter, particularly focused against women. And I think that the main point is that Twitter should put more resources. I mean, they're a $10 billion company, should put more resources and more effort into working out how to reduce and stop that. How they do it is
but what do you want them to
debated.
Stop? I mean, the death threats, the rape threats, threats of violence, they should certainly enforce their own policy when it comes to those sorts of things and suspend those people immediately and cooperate with the police in various localities where they're trying to prosecute them. Do you want them to go beyond that?
No, I mean, I think that they could, a good start would be enforcing their own policies, which they're not doing at the moment because they haven't got the resources to do so. And one of those policies does include harassment in Britain because people have to abide by the law of the land.
Absolutely.
On Twitter. So that is implicitly included.
Well, Stella,
I just need to break in here. You say working with the police. It's my understanding. First of all, we've had a report out this week from MPs saying we are losing the battle in this country on e-crime. We are not dealing with any of the victims of this, and we are one of the most targeted countries for that. The biggest sort of elephant in the room is that the police don't know how to deal with this. They are so scared, because all these people are committing crimes when we're talking about proper threats. They are under the malicious acts. They are completely breaking the law. So therefore, the police are compelled to act. One of the women who rang up to report the guy who said, or woman, who said, I'm going to put a bomb outside your house or whatever, the police officer that answered the phone to Catherine Mayer said, can you explain what Twitter is? Okay. You've also got the police in Scotland calling you a tit, Toby. So we've got police who are on Twitter at large calling people tits and abusing people, and we've also got the police not knowing what Twitter is. It's all very well, and I totally agree with Jake, that Twitter and Facebook are always playing catch-up. They grow far quicker than they ever realise, and they are creating the law on the hoof. They're kind of keeping up with it. However, the police, I know from people who talk to them, are so scared behind the scenes that they are going to have to deal with this properly, and they can't.
But I think it's a similar story with the police and with Twitter in that they're both playing catch-up. I mean, I know in the case of my death threat, which I received on Facebook, they had to pass it to Special Branch to deal with it because they were the people who knew about those sorts of things. And clearly, Special Branch can't deal with the great volume of crime that's being committed every day. And so I think it's a similar story. It's just, you know, the volume of crime and abuse that's taking place, it far outstrips the resources that are available either to Twitter or to the police.
And also, Toby, as a basic principle here, the Twitter publishes those tweets, right? So it's publishing content. If you wrote a letter to the Daily Telegraph, which was abusive, or even sexist, or even just simply foul-mouthed, we would have to take responsibility for that letter and for publishing it. And of course, we would not publish it. But it would be our responsibility. Well, so why not force Google to take responsibility for what people say on it?
Well, the problem with holding Twitter to the same standard as the Daily Telegraph and making Twitter legally responsible for everything people tweet in all their localities, which means they'd have to, you know, even embrace the law, enforce the law in Thailand that anyone who threatens or says anything disrespectful to the King of Thailand faces a 75-year jail sentence, if not a beheading. I mean, there's the problem, first of all, of getting Twitter to kind of enforce this kind of patchwork of probably in some cases incompatible international laws. But the problem with holding Twitter to the same standard as holding the Daily Telegraph and just regarding it as another publisher is then it's going to become super cautious and it would insist on proof of bona fides and it would kick people off all the time and it would just be a very different beast. I think there's got to be a technological solution. On Newsnight, Paul Mason on Tuesday night had talked to a software designer who had developed a program which largely screens out all known trolls and then you can enter Twitter via this gateway and not be abused by trolls. Now there are going to be some who kind of slip through the wire, but that seemed to me to have the makings of a solution to this problem which overcomes the problem of resources, which Jake's just flagged up.
Which lets us move on to the wider question of filtering, because it sounds like you're describing a sort of filtering there. Now, the Prime Minister has suggested that we also need to clamp down on certain varieties of porn to limit access to it and to make sure that children in particular can't see things through filters. Jake, is this puritanism or is this, again, a case of government catching up?
Well, I don't think it's puritanism. I think that the pendulum has swung too far the other way from since the sexual revolution. And I think that, as a parent, there are some very real concerns about the sexualization and the commercialization of childhood. And this goes back really to the Bailey Report, which was commissioned in 2010. By the coalition government, as you know, the coalition agreement does say that it wants to clamp down upon the commercialization and sexualization of childhood. And what Reg Bailey found is that 9 out of 10 parents share these concerns, that you have children who are, you know, under 7 years of age, who are who companies are marketing padded bras at them, T-shirts that say future porn star. You have the phenomenon of sexting, where children are, you know, sort of around the age of puberty and beyond, are texting each other pictures of their genitals, uninvited, I should add. You have online porn, which is becoming a sort of a paradigm of sexual activity, causing boys to become more misogynistic in their sexual attitudes and girls to become more kind of compliant against their will, perhaps, and so on and so on. I think that all of that does need to be dealt with, and 9 out of 10 parents believe that.
I read the Bailey Report for a blog post I was composing on Monday about the proposal by the co-op to insist that Lads Mags publishers place themselves in modesty bags, make some magazines in modesty bags if they're going to remain on sale at the co-op. And in the Bailey Report, Reg Bailey is honest enough to admit that there is no robust social science evidence that seeing the covers of magazines like Nuts and Loaded, if they're at eye level next to children's comics, children seeing them causes them any harm. But Reg Bailey's argument is, just in case they do harm children, we should insist that the publishers place them in modesty bags. But that argument, in the absence of evidence, we should err on the side of caution, just in case they are causing harm, that can be used to restrict free speech in all kinds of contexts. I mean, it could be an argument, for instance, for placing the Beano in a modesty bag on the grounds that Dennis the Menace is a negative role model. I've always felt that if you want to limit free speech, the burden of proof should be on those who want to limit it. It shouldn't be up to us to prove that these magazine covers don't cause any harm. It should be up to those who want to put them in modesty bags to prove that they cause harm.
Emma, can I bring in Emma at this point? Do you agree? Do we need to do something?
About filters or
about filtering, about Lads Mags? It has the pendulum swung the other way, and is it time for the government and society to sort of reorder the public sphere?
I think David Cameron means well. Let's just deal with things in turn. Regarding filters, I think he means well. I was listening to an interview with him on Woman's Hour, and he couldn't really give the detail as to if daddy wants to look at porn in one room and baby doesn't want to look at porn in the other, how that's actually going to work. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people writing into Woman's Hour, mainly men, interestingly, asking, how can I look at legal porn without my wife and child knowing? I mean, once you've got that going on, I think he's way in over his head. However, I do think you know, and Toby sort of muddled the water there. But I think what you were saying about porn, Jake, is very important. I'm talking to the NSPCC about some research at the moment, and there is a huge impact on girls and boys of porn, of how they think they should behave in relationships, of how the power politics between men and women should work. Sex currently in the education system that we have is taught in a very weird way. It's taught in biology about organs. It's taught in IT about safety online. And, you know, Michael Gove's trying to strip out words such as hormones from the curriculum at the moment. And we don't have mandatory sex education relationship in this country. And it's not taught in context of a relationship. So what you have, like I have, and I'm young enough to be at school when the internet was starting with dial-up, so I can talk from this point of view, we all just went online. And there are roles being pushed out there by pornographers, which men and women in their very young state are subscribing to. So I think it is changing the way we view sex. I think it is changing the way that we view ourselves. I think lots of girls feel that it's empowering to be dominated because that's how porn shows it. And men feel that's the way sex is going to be. I've spoken to men on my radio show late night where they're like, porn has completely distorted how I thought sex was going to be with a woman. So this is affecting young boys and young girls. If I could just come to the argument about magazines, and maybe people will be surprised to hear this. I don't go as far as the Beano argument, but I do agree with Toby that I don't think the modesty bags are going to do anywhere near the type of protection that will be required if we are going to go down this route of essentially censorship, when I know that most girls buy women's magazines, and on the front of women's magazines right now, if you just look at one of the glossies, there are a number of celebrities who are very beautiful, singers, Rita Ora is one that I'm thinking of, who are posing naked, not on the front of lads mags, but on the front of glossy fashion magazines. So if we are to put magazines in bags, we're going to have to put many other magazines and The Sun in a bag.
Right. Yeah. But of course, it's not a case of us doing that. I mean, in this specific case, it's the co-op.
Yes, I mean, I'm talking theoretically around...
It doesn't want to sell those things. And I think people are acting as though it's the government doing
No,
ban,
sorry, but I was trying to split off filters and the discussion of, you know, mags in bags.
I mean, there are two points I think I'd like to make about this. Firstly, Reg Bailey in his report, right, you know, quite early on, makes it very clear that he's not calling upon government legislation. He is asking to appeal to the better nature of companies, if you like, to try to cooperate and create a world which is more family-friendly rather than dominated by adult needs and adult desires. I think the second point that I wanted to make is to engage with what Toby was saying about how he says that I think there's no clear evidence at this stage that there is harm caused to children by seeing lads mags, let's say, on the shelf of a newsagent. Therefore, Reg Bailey is saying we should act preemptively, and Toby's saying that that's wrong. But I think that, I mean, if you look at how policy is made anyway, there is a reason why academics do not make our laws that politicians do, because politicians take on the policy advice from academics, which is based on their studies, combine it with public opinion, common sense of morals and decency, and it all goes into a mix, and that informs the policies that they make. And I think that in this case, you've got 9 out of 10 parents who are very concerned with the environment that children are growing up in and the influences it's had on them. Academics haven't yet been able to, you know, distill this into a single study which shows conclusively that harm is done. But it's a very, very difficult thing to do. You're talking about a multidisciplinary area. You're talking about a culture which is very difficult to test and control and have apply the scientific method to. And so I think it's absolutely right that if 9 out of 10 parents are concerned and the academics haven't got it together yet, we should seriously think about taking action.
Well, the problem with that, Jake, is you're ignoring the difficulty of protecting unpopular freedoms in democratic societies. It doesn't matter if 90% of people want to ban something because they wrongly imagine it's harmful. That shouldn't be a sufficient grounds for banning it if that's going to infringe on other people's freedoms.
But not talking about banning it. I mean, the government isn't going to ban it. The co-op are going to put their magazines in a bag. Not all retailers need to choose to do that. This is a voluntary thing. And what Bailey is trying to do is to give a report which will encourage people to try to row back against the tide of sexualisation, particularly with children in mind.
And also, even if that wasn't the case, even if we were talking about something that 10% of people do that 90% of them want to see banned, there are lots of things that we make that call on as a democracy. There are lots of things we ban which are unhealthy because we think they're bad for everyone because the majority wants it. That's how a democracy works. Why not apply that same standard
to
something that's scientifically proven to do damage to both children and women?
It's not scientifically proven. That's the point. In the absence of any concrete evidence that it causes any harm, should we ban it anyway just because people don't like it?
Anecdotal evidence from
anecdotal evidence,
people...
a poor basis for making policy, isn't it?
You've got children, Toby.
Yes.
Have they watched porn? How old are they?
On an anecdotal basis, I can tell you that when my children buy comics in shops, supermarkets that don't put nuts and loaded immodesty bags, they don't notice them. They don't have it. I think more generally, Dan Hodges has got.
You've got children. I just want to know. You say there's no scientific evidence, and you want to run away from the effect that this has on children and the effect that it has on men and women's.
But you're talking about the effect as though that's a given when I'm telling you there isn't any evidence that it has a negative impact.
I'm asking you, as a parent, how would you feel if your son got all of his sex education from looking at lads mags and watching porn?
I'm not sure there's much I'll be able to do about that, Emma, however vigilant I am as a parent.
But how do you think it would affect it?
I think, if you look at boys growing up in societies where... pornography is completely banned, where there aren't any magazines like Nuts or Loaded sold, say, Saudi Arabia, parts of India. There's no evidence that men's attitude towards women is any healthier, is there? I mean, instances of rape, of violence against women in oppressive Middle Eastern societies
are no lower,
are they?
No, but I mean, they're much, much higher. In the context of restricted sex. I'm talking about what's going on in your son's skull.
I'm not too concerned about... I think it would be naive of me as a parent to imagine that I could somehow create a protective bubble. I think it's naive of the government. It seems to me it's sort of a gesture to introduce these porn filters. It's not really going to have much impact. And I think the problem with feminists like Stella Creasy and others putting all this emphasis on policing Twitter, on filtering the internet, on banning lads mags covers or encouraging supermarkets to voluntarily play, etc., etc., is it just seems a very cosmetic area to be focusing all their energy on. If they want to do something about real harm to women, about real sexual injustice, why not campaign to try and prevent female genital mutilation?
About them, they've got one campaign that they can do at a time. Women can multitask. Did you not get that? Okay, let me just respond to that because you say feminist light. You've got a feminist sat in the room. I hope I've got many more. There are lots of men in here because we need you. But the situation is this. By polarising it the way you are, I think there's a really interesting nostalgia going
on. Why am I polarising?
Just to hit me out for a minute. Last month or 2 months ago, Rod Liddell did this big piece in the Times around feminists of yesteryear and how he misses Germaine Greer. And I'm sure he didn't feel like that at the time because feminism back then used to be something that was really easy to understand. There were still battles to be won that were black and white. And actually, they got the laws changed. I'm talking about pay. I'm talking about all these sorts of things. But the attitudes haven't caught up yet. So the feminist battles of today might not be as black and white as you would like. They require more oblique tools. And just saying, why don't they go and campaign against real harm? There's a lot of real harm that is done by allowing attitudes to remain as they are, and they are not tangible things. So don't think that feminists like Stella are, first of all feminists. Second of all, don't think that they are able to campaign on one thing at one time.
I think my case against campaigning on attitudes and doing it in quite an aggressive, censorious way.
You're not aggressive at all, are you, Toby? Is
twofold. First of all, it seems to be misplaced, and that if they could direct, well, if campaigning groups could direct as much energy towards, for instance, trying to prohibit female genital mutilation in this country.
There's a lot of energy on that.
Okay, good.
Talk to editors, see if they'll put it in the paper.
The other problem is it's quite hard. It's naive to imagine that you can go out there and change attitudes, that you can kind of somehow re-educate society by encouraging the co-op or threatening the co-op with legal repercussions if it doesn't place lad mags in modesty bags.
But I mean, society's been re-educated by the internet. Society has been re-educated by the ubiquitous nature of 24-hour free porn.
I mean, I'm all for you making the case, Emma, as robustly and aggressively as you want.
But it seems to be going
a step too far.
Didn't you compare feminists to the Taliban
to try and prohibit certain forms of expression? That just seems to be going too far. far.
You're not answering my questions, Toby.
No, I did. I compared the groups that have been campaigning to ban LADMEX.
But do you not understand what I'm saying when I say there are loads of very energetic people, women and men, campaigning against FGM? At the same time, there are other groups campaigning to put lads mags in bags, whether you agree with that or not. You seem to only be able to focus on one thing yourself at a time.
That's why I'm a man, so I can't multitask, Emma. But I think that's one component. But the other component is, in the public square, why not present your case as robustly as you can and try and persuade people to modify their behaviour? Why try and enlist other methods, particularly legal methods, to try and prohibit the behaviour you disapprove of? That seems to me to be a threat to freedom.
We've got some more agreement on that area, to be fair.
Okay, I want to finish by asking Jake, do you think there's a connection between the two subjects we've covered here, the abuse on Twitter and the vast, terrifying availability of pornography on the internet? Do you think there's a link between those two? Is the free availability of sexist, misogynistic images partly responsible for the kind of abuse we're reading online?
Well, I don't know. I await an academic study to prove the connection between the two. I mean, it's easy to speculate that perhaps the great availability of rape porn and aggressive porn is leading to a more aggressive attitude from young men towards women on Twitter. I mean, you can sort of postulate that. There's no way really of knowing. But I think that the main point is that what we're trying to do as a society is something that's quite new. I mean, we're living largely in a post-Christian age where Christian morals are no longer, on the whole, driving mainstream society quite as much as they have done in the past. We are post-sexual revolution. People have been following the pursuit of freedom at all costs in many different areas of our lives. And parents now are turning around and saying, actually, it seems that things have gone too far. How do we begin to change that back without banning things, without restricting free speech, getting people to make changes voluntarily rather than obligating them to do so? I think parents particularly feel quite disempowered because of the massive role that the media is playing in their children's lives. And those parents are saying, well, what can we do about it? We can't stem this tide. We need some help. And that's where companies need to take their responsibilities a little more seriously and begin to protect children as well as promote the needs of adults.
Jake Wallace-Simons, Toby Young and Emma Barnett, thank you very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.